Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to.
It's a living.
Here's John Williams.
Hi, it's John. We even do it on the stream. Yeah, we're not on WGN Radio right now. That's White Sox Baseball. You found us at WGNradio.com or wherever you're listening to us on the stream. This is a different version of what you're hearing on the radio side today. We don't quit working just because the White Sox are. We are here in Studio A until 3 o'clock. Remember, you'll be able to hear all of your favorite shows on WGN Radio with or without the White Sox. You want to catch the game? Go to WGN Radio. I'm cool with that, but if you're here, thank you for being here, and thank you for tuning us in. Speaking of sports, Simone Biles' athletic feat at the U.S. National Championship last weekend was absolutely incredible. We spoke briefly about it at the beginning of yesterday's show, and I actually found a really interesting article about that at Slate.com, which we'll talk about after 1:30 with the woman who wrote it. When Simone Biles did that pass to open her floor routine, she did that double triple, a double flip with three spins in the air. You look at it, and in slow motion, it looks impossible. I watched it so many times. And we asked out loud yesterday, I wonder how high Simone Biles was at the peak of her spinning, and they've estimated that she was over 9 feet in the air. She is 4'8" tall. What's up with that?
Well, those are springs underneath the floor there, so that obviously helps. But to actually get that kind of height, you have to hit it perfectly to just really pounce up. It's like a trampoline and a double bounce. You really need the perfect kind of formula for that to work.
Exactly. And then you got to be able to do all that stuff, which nobody ever has.
Yeah, that's hard enough.
It'll be an interesting conversation at 1:35. Now, in this half hour, I wanted to talk about poetry because people stop me on the street all the time and they say, John, actually, nobody's ever said this, but why don't you talk a little bit more about poetry? But poetry's in the news today. Why? Because the administration wants to execute the public charge rule. That is a regulation that will ban immigrants if the government believes that they might use welfare. Officials say this protects us taxpayers. It ensures also that new arrivals will be self-sufficient. So how fluent should they have to be in English? What skills do they need? What kind of projected income should they have? Are all topics in the news today. So Jim Acosta, yes, that Jim Acosta from CNN, asked the president's economics advisor, Stephen Miller, about that this week.
What you're proposing here, what the president is proposing here, does not sound like it's in keeping with American tradition when it comes to immigration. Statue of Liberty says, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, yearning to breathe free. It doesn't say anything about speaking English or being able to be a computer programmer. Aren't you trying to change what it means to be an immigrant coming into this country?
The Statue of Liberty is a symbol of liberty enlightening the world. It's a symbol of American liberty lighting the world. The poem that you're referring to that was added later is not actually part of the original Statue of Liberty, but more fundamentally,
Jim, let me ask you a question.
So they went on like that for over 6 minutes, by the way. Then on National Public Radio, the acting director of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, Ken Cuccinelli. Now the Statue of Liberty and what's it mean? What is the poem and the statue itself? What do they mean is in play. So NPR had the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services director, the acting director, Ken Cuccinelli, on, and they asked him about the poem, and in their conversation, he revised one of the lines.
Give me your tired and your poor who can stand on their own 2 feet.
Ah, who can stand on their own 2 feet.
And yeah, there's a very small asterisk apparently. Like,
evidently.
You don't know these little specific details.
I didn't know that was in there.
You know, on the Mincing Rascals a few weeks ago, Justin Kaufman created Chicago Jail?
Yes, he did.
This is American blasphemy.
How do you mean?
I mean, it's blasphemous to take that poem and to change the words like he did. for your political reasons.
So he should be in America jail.
I don't want to put him in jail, but I just was listening to it yesterday, and it's blasphemous to our culture.
Well, so you'd think that given a second chance to fix that, he'd fix it. But he appeared with Aaron Burnett on CNN, and the soundbite that you're going to hear most often today is this.
Well, of course, that poem was referring back to people coming from Europe where they had class-based societies where people were considered wretched if they weren't in the right class.
So wow. He's not backing away from it. He said, no, that was always you had to be in the right class. That's who we were talking about. Maybe he's right. By the way, a longer version, a more illuminating version of that conversation with Aaron Burnett goes like this.
What do you think America stands for?
Well, of course, that poem was referring back to people coming from Europe where they had class-based societies where people were considered wretched if they weren't in the right class. And it was introduced, it was written one year after the first federal public charge rule was written that says, and I'll quote it, any person unable to take care of himself without becoming a public charge, unquote, would be inadmissible, or in the terms that my agency deals with, they can't do what's called adjusting status, getting a green card, becoming legal permanent residents. Same exact time.
So the two topics today are, you know, what should we do today? What credentials should immigrants have? And number two, have we been fooled all along? Was the poem on the Statue of Liberty never for the people that we thought it was for? A poem was written in 1883 by Emma Lazarus as a fundraiser for a pedestal upon which the Statue of Liberty would stand. 20 years later, in 1903, a bronze plaque with that poem was affixed to the base of the Statue of Liberty. And you've probably not heard the whole poem. It's still very short, and it reads like this. Not like the brazen giant of Greek fame, with conquering limbs astride from land to land, here at our sea-washed sunset gates shall stand a mighty woman with a torch, whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, and her name, Mother of Exiles. From her beaconed hand glows worldwide welcome. Her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor that twin cities frame. Keep, ancient lands, your storied pomp, cries she with silent lips. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Emma Lazarus. All right, so what did she mean by that?
Well, one thing that stood out to me, worldwide. Not Europe. Worldwide.
I like the part of it that says, a mighty woman with a torch whose flame, mother of exiles, her beacon hand worldwide, which was the part that kind of jumped out at me when I read it the first time. The business about pomp. Keep ancient lands, your storied pomp. Give me, and I don't need the fancy. Just give me the regular folks who need a hand.
I don't need the rich who are going to come here and get jobs. I mean, and come here for professional reasons.
Give,
which is a big part of immigration.
Yeah, keep ancient lands, your storied pomp, cries she. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses. Some people think that this last part is a little condescending. Yeah, maybe some people do need a hand up, says me. It's really beautiful prose or poetry, isn't it?
Well, we're also confusing U.S. policy with poetry, right? I mean, because she says homeless, right? The phrase homeless.
Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. What's right. Your point, Steve?
Well, if Cuccinelli's standard is you have to be able to stand on your own 2 feet, the homeless probably don't meet that criteria.
You know, it makes sense. I think that, you know, there's two conversations here. One is, what should the U.S. policy be? The other one is, what is the poem talking about? One's an ideal. One's something more pragmatic. I get the conversation about, well, we shouldn't just, you know, be an ATM for everybody that can get over here. Let's actually make sure they have some qualifications. So I get that conversation. But I do not want to at least dismiss the ideal that the Statue of Liberty I always thought was about. Some of you aren't going to be great contributors. Some of you might be. That's not the point. The point is we know that you need a safe harbor, and that's what we will be.
And that goes back to my first point. Well, you're right. There are two different conversations. But to take that poem and to add those words is American blasphemy.
Yeah. You know who I reached out to today to talk a little bit about this was Elizabeth Metzger Sampson. She's the executive director of the Chicago Poetry Center. She's listening online to this conversation. Elizabeth, John Williams, you're on WGN Radio. How are you?
Hi, I'm great. Thanks for having me.
So you've been listening to all of that. What's the first thing you want to say?
Yeah, well, so, you know, I think that Miller and Cuccinelli are both quite a bit confused with this poem that, frankly, doesn't leave a lot open to interpretation. She's pretty straightforward and literal in her poem. So, first of all, to Miller, the poem was actually written before the statue was erected. It just wasn't put on it until after. And she wrote it specifically to fundraise money for the statue. She actually wasn't going to at first, and a fellow writer convinced her to by telling her that this would be of great import to immigrants coming into that harbor. So that gives us a little bit of a frame for Emma Lazarus's thinking at that point in time, that she really wrote this for immigrants to be this sort of, you know, welcoming message as they came in. And to me, the poem makes that pretty clear straight through. You know, she starts by saying, not like the giant of Greek fame. So not like this conquering colossus from the past. But no. Here's this mighty woman who is welcoming you. Her name is the Mother of Exiles, and she's holding out her lamp. And she specifically says, it glows with worldwide welcome. So I'm not sure how you can get just Europe from that line. You know, whether we're speaking from a geographical perspective or a literature perspective, I'm not sure how you could get Europe only from this Mother of Exiles glows with worldwide welcome.
If what Stephen Miller was talking about was U.S. policy at the time, or
Cuccinelli.
Or Ken Cuccinelli. Miller talked about it too, but you're right, Steve, it's Cuccinelli that spoke more about that. If that was the U.S. policy at the time, she's not writing about that either way, correct?
Right, and she's specifically trying to urge forward the America that she hopes will be America's identity. And of course, her poem does very much become, you know, the identity marker, the meaning with the Statue of Liberty that it has maintained since 1903. But that was very much her goal. She was an activist who was supporting Jewish refugees and immigrants from Europe at the time. She was particularly concerned about the Chinese Exclusion Act at the time. And so, you know, in writing this, she's specifically saying, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, those who are homeless, tempest tossed. To me, that does not sound like she's saying someone who is currently standing on their own two feet.
Yeah, I'm looking in here for even a hint of that. You know, there's not even the tiniest door for that framing of this poem, is there?
There really isn't, and her meaning is just so clear from, you know, her beacon glows with worldwide welcome to send me the homeless and the tempest tossed. All the way through, her meaning is quite clear that she wants America to be seen in opposition to the current closed borders of Europe. At the time she was writing the poem, she was very worried about what was happening in Europe, and she wanted America to stand up as this new and beautiful beacon of welcoming citizens from across the world.
By the way, at the time, there was no such thing as a welfare state, as you might know it in the country today. So comparing maybe the issues that we're dealing with and how we accommodate immigrants or what they can bring to us versus what the framework was back then is really apples and oranges. There was no welfare state. People were supported by churches, almshouses, family members, etc. So I don't know what to make of all of that, but I think that it's not as clear trying to apply the standards then to the issues that we're dealing with today. It's interesting to me, too, that as a woman in the late 19th century, she would have not been a full participating member of society herself, right? She wouldn't have been able to vote, for instance.
That's right.
If do you know, I asked you this off the air, I don't know if you or I know if she was Jewish or not, but I know that she, her papers are housed at a Jewish organization. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. Her original manuscript for this poem is at the American Jewish Historical Society in New York, and they note in their records on her that, that she was quite an activist of Jewish causes at the time. So, indeed, she would have been dealing with several issues for, you know, personally, for not being treated as a full citizen, including being a woman and not being able to vote, as you said.
Here at our sea-washed sunset gates shall stand a mighty woman with the torch, whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, and her name Mother of Exiles. I just love that imagery. You can imagine an immigrant coming across, having survived an Atlantic crossing, and then sort of seeing the Statue of Liberty and literally believing that when the doors open, there's going to be a light and they have a chance. What a wonderful image.
That's right. And it's also useful to look at it with the two lines before it, not like the brazen giant of Greek fame with conquering limbs astride from land to land. So she's saying, here's this woman who is welcoming you as opposed to this sort of conqueror aspect. A lot of the poem is set up in opposition to Europe, saying, no, here there will be this feminine, welcoming, mighty figure. And of course, that's repeated at the end when, this mother of exiles lifts her lamp beside the golden door, right? So the golden door, she's welcoming them into America.
The whole idea feels so comforting here. Her mild eyes command the harbor that the Twin Cities frame. And then she says, keep ancient lands your storied pomp. Give me your tired, as though that would be preferable. You want to cry at the compassion that this statue is supposedly showing. I don't want the pomp. I want the tired, the poor, the huddled, those that are just yearning to breathe free. I don't know what to make of the phrase wretched refuse. There is some writing today about that. What do you make of those two words?
Right. You know, I mean, it's probably not language that that very same poet, I would imagine, would use today to speak in the same way. But I believe what she's saying is essentially those that are cast off by a society. So, you know, those that are in the margins, those that are unwelcome, those that are unsupported, which would be, of course, why they are fleeing and why they need a new home that her mother of exiles is going to welcome.
Right, but if we were sympathetic today, we're so sensitive to other peoples and cultures, we probably would not describe the cast-offs as wretched refuse.
Absolutely not.
So we'd find another way to maybe say that from your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed, describing their trip to me. And then finally, I lift my lamp beside the golden door. Well, hopefully we get through all of this and still think of, or the world will still think of, the gates to America is a golden door. I don't know how we all feel about that now, but at least that's what Emma Lazarus was asking us to aspire to over 100 years ago. Last thought from you?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I think it's really worthwhile to think about this poem as we see the ongoing news about all of our immigration crises at the moment and ask ourselves as a country, is this what we're offering? Is this what we're welcoming? And if it isn't, do we still believe in this poem? And if we do, what do we need to change to make this true of us as a nation?
Right. If we're going to chuck this thing, let's take it down, kids. Let's just go ahead and we can chisel it right off the side. I'm not kidding. If this does not represent America's ideals, fine. Let's at least be honest about it and put something else up there. I don't know what it would say. Somebody's going to write that, I've been thinking today. But for now, it stands, and I hope it stays. Elizabeth Metzger Sampson is the executive director of the Chicago Poetry Center. What a great resource that is for us in Chicago, both the center and you, Elizabeth. Visit poetrycenter.org, poetrycenter.org. Anything else we can do for you today, Elizabeth?
No, thank you very much for having me. If you guys want to check out our next event, we're doing our annual Poetry on a Boat reading with poets Tara Betts and Avery R. Young on August 29th at 6 p.m. You can find out all the details at poetrycenter.org. Join us for Poetry on the Chicago River.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Let's stay in touch. I want to find another reason to talk to you down the road.
Sounds great. Thank you.
That's Elizabeth Metzger-Sampson from the Chicago Poetry Center. Into the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Steve Bertrand's got the news. That's next. Okie dokie, it's time for WGN Radio News. After that, we will visit with Rebecca Schumann. She writes for Slate. She follows the sports scene, particularly gymnastics. Simone Biles winning the U.S. gymnastics title after a first day that wasn't that good by her standards is an interesting story. But I'm especially interested in just what the heck she did. There was a couple of physical feats that she performed in that may be regarded as among the most impressive athletic physical feats ever performed. I'm thinking about Bob Beamon jumping 29 feet, 2.5 inches a long, long time ago. Or, I don't know, Usain Bolt running the 200 meters and slowing up at the tape and yet still breaking the world record. Just what are some of the greatest physical athletic feats ever accomplished? And they're putting Biles in that conversation. After the news, into the WGN Radio Newsroom, this is Steve Bertrand.
What was the first video to play on MTV?
Video Killed the Radio Star.
Yeah, Video Killed the Radio Star.
Radio Star.
Oh, yes, it was that one. That's how I do trivia. Somebody gets it right, and then I go, oh, yeah, it was that one. And I'm very sure of it after you give me the correct answer. Like, if you'd thrown in a wrong answer there, I would have gone, I don't think so. But if you tell me what the right answer is, I know. And to me, that's tantamount to knowing.
I made my son watch it once with me.
Did he think that, wow, that's cool? Or did he just go, yeah, you old people really...
Worse, Eddie Haskell, me. He said it was really interesting.
I didn't know that was a phrase. He Eddie Haskell me. But that's pretty good. That's when your son, daughter, or friend says, yeah, no, these brownies are terrific, Mrs. Cleaver. Is that it?
Oh, I like that car, Mr. Cleaver. Yeah.
By the way, 309 texted in and said, taking down the poem from the Statue of Liberty takes away the entire ideal of the Statue of Liberty. The horror of the last scene from the Planet of the Apes comes to mind immediately. I did not see that coming. But at the end of the Planet of the Apes, where he falls to his knees and you see what he saw, and it's literally just the top of the Statue of Liberty sticking out of the sand, you think, oh my God, it's all over. And so too would be the removal of the poem or the ideals behind it, says 309. Thanks for that thoughtful text message. You can always call or text. We are 312-981-7200. I'm John Williams. This is WGN Radio and WGNRadio.com. Gymnast Simone Biles won the 2019 U.S. Gymnastics Overall Championship. Was reading a little bit about that after we were talking about it yesterday, and we were all marveling at the videos that are out there of her doing the double-double off the beam, where she does two backhand springs into a double flip in the air and lands on the mats, and then her opening pass on the floor exercise, where she runs real fast, then starts springing backwards, boing, boing, boing. I'm not having the exact phrases. This isn't exactly the terminology they use. And then she went about 40 feet in the air. She did two full flips and three twists. And landed like, yeah, what's your point? Rebecca Schumann wrote about this at Slate.com. This was last Friday in Kansas City. And she's actually pretty good on the topic. Thanks for joining us today, Rebecca. You're on WGN in Chicago. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. So do you write about sports generally, women's sports, gymnastics? What's your beat over there?
I specialize in gymnastics. I used to be a gymnast myself, and so I specialize in gymnastics coverage.
So as a gymnast, like, what was your personal reaction to? I guess it's not like you weren't aware of her ability, but just in general, what did you think of what happened this weekend or what she's able to accomplish by and large?
Well, I've been watching Simone Biles closely for 6 years since she burst onto the elite scene, and I really thought that I couldn't be surprised by her amazingness anymore, because I felt like I'd seen it all. Every time she took 2 years off after almost 2 years off after the Rio Olympics, and then came back somehow better than before last year, and then this year she came back with these two skills that are just off the charts. They're almost incomprehensible. And I have to say that as a professional gymnastics journalist, my reaction when I first saw her do that triple double skill on floor was to run around my room screaming.
Well, I described it maybe poorly. What else would you tell us about that?
Actually, you'd be surprised. The technical term is actually that you run like mad and then do a bunch of springy things.
Boing,
and then
boings, yeah.
Approximately. Boing, boing. So it's interesting that you mentioned her approach, because that's not often what people pay attention to when gymnasts do spectacular high-flying skills like that. But the secret to how she could execute the triple-double is actually in her approach. It's called a round-off back handspring. And it's a skill that any gymnast at pretty much any level can do. It's one of the most basics, and people often take it for granted. But hers is so immensely powerful that it allows her to rack it up into the air, not actually 40 feet high, but pretty darn close to 10. Which for a 4'8" human being is pretty spectacular.
Well, you know, that's what actually got me to you, because after we talked about the video yesterday, I started to Google around, like, how high did she get in the air? And then there was a piece in the New York Times that went to great length in a video article talking about the mechanics of what she did. And they estimated she was 9.5 feet high. My colleague here, Lauren Lapka, reminded me that there are maybe little springs in the mats or something, so I don't know how. I know that would help them on the fall, but that must help them on the elevation as well, right?
It does a bit. There are 11 centimeters of coiled springs in the floor exercise mat, but there have been for the last 50 or 60 years, and no one has done a triple-double until now.
Do the men do that?
It's definitely not. About 3 men in the world can do a triple-double, and you know what? Simone Biles' technique and height are better.
Does her body size and frame help her in some way?
Immensely. She has the exact ideal body for women's gymnastics. She's very tiny, but she's extraordinarily strong and powerful. Her physical conditioning is, you know, probably one of the best even among elite athletes in the world. And then she combines this incredibly perfect gymnastics body with really, really, really once-in-a-lifetime focus and determination and willingness to perfect her technique over and over and over again. And so often people will say, oh, well, Simone Biles, she must be a superhero. She must be a robot. She's not human. And that actually discounts one of the most amazing things about her, which is how hard she has worked to make her technique perfect. When she first came on the scene, she had the power, but she was a hot mess. She was really out of control, and she has worked incredibly hard. She is very human, and she's worked incredibly hard for the last decade to harness that power in a way that makes her able to do those skills.
I wonder how dangerous it is. If you got lost in the middle of that spinning and flipping, you could break your neck.
Absolutely, but another thing that makes Simone Biles so incredible is that one thing that her very first coach noticed about her when she was just a little kid is that she has an extraordinary amount of what gymnasts call air awareness, and that's basically just what it sounds like. It's understanding exactly where you are in relationship to the ground while you're spinning around, and so she's not actually lost up there. She knows exactly where she is, amazingly enough, in those fast flips and twists. The other thing to realize when somebody is doing a trick like that is that they've been training it for years, yeah. And you don't start it on a mat like that. You start it on a very soft sort of trampoline-like tumbling surface that goes into a giant pit full of foam, so you can land on your head and not be injured. So, you know, there are many steps of training a skill like that. By the time you're on the competition floor, that thing is second nature to you, and so it isn't dangerous for her anymore. But obviously, I'm not going to go try it.
Well, I relate this way to what you're describing. When I was a teenager, I always wanted to try and do a double flip off the diving board. And that took just a certain amount of courage, because everybody can do a flip, and a 1.5 is kind of fun. But, you know, you just got to lead with your nose and go into the water. The double was like spin, spin, and then open up at the right time. And I was always nervous about A, just being able to spin enough, but B, knowing when to open up. So the one day I tried it off the high dive there at Memory Lane in Joliet, in Shorewood, just outside of Joliet. My brother was watching, and I spun, and then I spun, and then I opened up. And I noticed as I opened up, I was looking at the sky. The blue sky was up there. And I'm straight, as flat as a pancake now, but I'm like, and you know, it's like time slows down. I'm thinking, I don't think I should be looking at the sky. Wham! Backflop right onto the water. And I thought I was going to die. I come to, and my brother's just laughing at me. But don't worry, I've completely forgot about this. I'm not bitter about it. The point of all of that is that one time I tried that,
I got completely discombobulated. Now imagine throwing three twists into that and being able to complete the double and not landing in the water but on your feet and then moving on right away to music, for crying out loud.
So you didn't try to get that dive named after you?
It is.
Maybe you.
I actually think the one and three quarters is at Memory Lane Swimming Hole in Shorewood is in fact named the John Williams. So
the perfect backflop.
We're done talking about that now. Let's go to the let's go to the beam, because while that's not as pretty to watch, maybe that to me is even harder to do. She doesn't have the benefit of 11 centimeters of spring. She jumps off that padded board and does a double flip, right?
With two twists in it. Lots of gymnasts can do a double flip off of the balance beam, although not everybody in the elite world can. It's considered one of the harder dismounts to do a double flip. But to do a double flip with one twist in it, which is what Simone Biles used to compete, was at the time the absolute N plus ultra, highest bar possible for a difficult beam, because people were, you know, blown away by it. So for her to throw another flip in that and do a double-double is still considered a very difficult skill on the floor. And so for her to do it off the beam is basically her just blowing the whole top off gymnastics and being like, sorry, gymnastics, you're done. I've changed you now. We live in my world now. It was that was another run around the room screaming moment for me.
Well, what is the separation between her and the next woman in the competition? Is it evident, or are there other ladies that are right there on her heels?
She has a couple events where she is not as incredibly better than everybody else. And uneven bars has always been sort of her nemesis, and she does have several people in the world who can nip at her heels there. She probably won't win Olympic gold on uneven bars. But on the other three, with her balance beam, there are some balance beam workers who have routine skills that are as hard as hers, but nobody comes close to that dismount. And then when it comes to the floor exercise and the vault, she could fall, take an absolute full-on, on her rear end fall on both of those events and win an Olympic gold medal, because her difficulty is so much harder than everybody else. She routinely wins competitions, as she just did, by more than 4 points. So that would mean that she could have fallen four more times and still won.
815 texted in and said, hey, John Williams, my first thought after that floor routine was, oh, my God, can she dunk? She should put a basketball between her legs or something and do a reverse back handspring dunk of a basketball. She was high enough to do that.
I think she's probably been offered that opportunity before, and, you know, that does carry a little risk of injury for her, but I wouldn't be surprised if she tried to do that after Tokyo.
How is there not a video of that?
No longer training.
You know, and seriously, though, she could do a boing, 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 and then I don't know what she does, but then, bam, she's 4'9", and she slam dunks a basketball while doing some sort of handsprings or twisty things. This is the Simone Biles story. Her routine was at the U.S. Gymnastics Championship. So she won the overall, she won the floor. Did she win other medals at that particular event?
Yeah, she won everything but the uneven bars. And she came in, I think, second or third. So, yeah, she pretty much swept the whole thing. And that's generally going to be expected in Tokyo at the Olympics as well. The one somewhat wild card of balance beam, because she does tend to get the nerves up there. In Rio, she had a big error on the balance beam and still won a medal. She won the bronze medal with a near fall. And so she sort of is back with a vengeance to try to claim that gold medal again in Tokyo. So
well, then,
I would be...
If I'm the woman from,
I'd be surprised if she didn't.
If I'm a woman from St. Paul, I believe it was a Minnesota woman who was second to her at the national championships. I mean, any female really wants to be on her team, I guess, because she's kind of going to carry you to the finish line, right?
Well, the joke in gymnastics is that you have Simone, and then everybody else is competing for first place non-Simone division.
Yeah, no kidding. You know, the last time we talked about gymnastics on this show was when we talked about the UCLA woman, Caitlin Ohashi, and how much fun she was to watch and how good her skills were. In fact, I've talked to her coach a couple of times. I guess her coach has since retired, but she said, mm-hmm. you know, she would be one of the most competitive Olympic contenders if she chose to, but Ohashi mm-hmm. has decided she doesn't want to go that route. She doesn't want the pressure and the constant training, etc. If you haven't seen the Caitlin Ohashi videos, just Google it. They're some of the most joyful, amazing things you've ever seen. She does one thing where she goes boing, 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 goes up in the air, and then lands in the splits, which maybe a lot of the gals can do, but it's just remarkable to watch. Now, talk to me just briefly about Caitlin and maybe compare and contrast her.
Yeah. Have you ever thought about auditioning to be a gymnastics commentator, John? I think that it would be good to see you be like, boing, boing, boing.
I do feel the skill kind of emerging here, yeah.
I think you've got an actual gift. So here's a fun fact about Caitlin Ohashi. She and Simone Biles are best friends. They used to compete together on the elite circuit before Caitlin Ohashi retired from elite competition. And Caitlin Ohashi was the last person in the world to beat Simone Biles. She beat her at a 2013 competition. Caitlin Ohashi was at one point the absolute best gymnast in the world, but she had a lot of injuries and she was under an immense amount of pressure, and so she decided to retire from elite competition, and she was, you know, I think 16 or 17 years old. And what she could have done is probably very similar to Simone Biles in stature, but for her, it just, elite competition just broke her. It broke her spirit. She was very wounded and physically, mentally, psychologically. It's a very punishing world. And so she wasn't even sure she wanted to go back into gymnastics at all. And it was through her friendship with Valerie Condos Field at UCLA that she was inspired to go back into gymnastics. And when she went back in, she decided she was going to do it her way and she was going to have fun. And she sort of brought the whole world along with that. And it's been fantastic.
Yeah, those videos are worth watching if you haven't. Just Google Caitlin Ohashi, UCLA, and the routines are marvelous. That's the last thing maybe I'll just ask you about. I know her coach said it's too bad that the super competitive elite world, the Olympics track, isn't as joyful as what the NCAA track looked like. I'm not sure if that's entirely true, but the Ohashi videos are more fun, even if the Biles are more spectacular.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in many ways, that's an unfair comparison because the world of NCAA gymnastics is just different than elite gymnastics. It's not like other sports such as, you know, basketball is the most known, or football, where you have players who are essentially not yet peaked in their careers and they are going on to the professional leagues after their college career. In gymnastics, it's the reverse. They have their glory in the elite world and then they go to college. And college is sort of their victory lap. The skill level of the NCAA code of points is much less rigorous than the elite one. And so they don't have to, they're capped at 20 weeks, 20 hours a week of training, and they are encouraged to focus on their studies and focus on their lives and their preparation for their careers. It's just a completely different world. And I don't really know of any professional elite sport where the athlete is also required to be happy and, you know, joyful all the time. Like, no one is like, oh, LeBron doesn't seem to be enjoying this enough.
I was looking at a list of the most, I Googled it a number of ways, like most awe-inspiring physical feats by athletes or something like that. So you get Bob Beamon's 29, 2.5-inch long jump in the 1968 Olympics, which is still the Olympic record. It's not the world record, but only by a fraction of inch did anybody, even in the world, jump farther than Bob Beamon did in 1968. And when Beamon broke the long jump record, he jumped 29 feet, 2.5 inches. Get out a tape measure and measure it sometime. It's stunning. When he did that, he broke the existing world record. A lot of times they'll shave an inch, half an inch off a world record when you get to that level. Beamon broke the world record when he jumped 29, 2.5 by almost 2 feet. It took them forever to measure it, and they were wondering why, and they said, because we don't have a device long enough at this Olympics. So they had to go get another tape measure to measure it. And then when they told him how far it was, he collapsed. He literally couldn't stand. It was just so weird. So that's got to be up there. And then the list goes on of things like Flojo's 10.62 in the 100-meter dash. You could put some other particular, and the four-minute mile the first time maybe. Usain Bolt's 200 meters two Olympics ago was really something to behold. But I thought about Simone Biles' performance last weekend. And then some of these, when I saw her on the videos this week, it was really something to see. At Slate.com, you can read our guest. Visit Slate.com and catch up with the world of... Is it always going to be now gymnastics for you?
I write first, about many other subjects, but no other sports subjects. So for the sports world, I'm all about gymnastics.
She's a good writer, Rebecca Schumann. Rebecca, thanks for talking to
Thank
us today.
You.
Good luck to you. I appreciate your time.
You too. Have a great day. All right.
154. Okay, we'll pause here. We'll head into the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom. Steve Bertrand's got the latest. I want to talk about that shooting when we come back in the 2 o'clock hour. That 70-plus-year-old fella, five kids stealing his car. And one of them's coming at him with a knife. He pulls out his gun and shoots one of them dead. And I think you may have something to say about that. Plus, Pete McMurray's going to swing through. He's interviewing Mayor Lori Lightfoot. We need to help Pete with this in the 2 o'clock. One other note about Bob Beamon's jump. It's a pet topic of mine. Read books about it. Just, I was a long jumper when I was a kid in school. You know, you do your very best, and then you go, wow, somebody did 10 feet farther than that, and it's pretty amazing. And at that Olympics in Mexico City in 1968, when Beamon jumped 29 feet 2 1/4, you know, they didn't know how far it was because they didn't have a device to measure it. And then they put up the amount, the distance, and it was 8-point-something meters. But, you know, he's from the United States, so none of us knows what that means. So the crowd gasps that he's walking around like, okay, what's 8.9 meters? If he said, hey, you jumped 8.9 meters, I really wouldn't know. So he still didn't know how far he jumped. And then somebody gave him the conversion, and the guy collapsed. He couldn't stand. 29, 2, and something. Here's another list. Most amazing superhuman sports feats. Roger Bannister running the sub-4-minute mile as a student without the sort of track and shoes and modern aids, if you will, that runners have today. He was running on a cinder track. I don't know if this should be in there. Should this be in there? Felix Baumgartner. The guy that jumped out of the Red Bull balloon 128,000 feet above the Earth's surface and is in there for skydiving. I don't know that that's the same as running a 4-minute mile. Gertrude Ederle in swimming in 1926 swam the English Channel. Only a few men had done it before, and then she did it 2 hours faster than any man ever had. I like that they have Tony Hawk in there for skateboarding. I'm a Tony Hawk fan, too. And Tony Hawk did the 900, right? 2.5 midair spins on a skateboard. So he does that, but they, I think, rightly say, almost as remarkable, Hawk landed his signature 900 again in 2016 at the age of 48. Were you ever 48? Do you know a 48-year-old? Ask them if they can do anything 2.5 times, let alone spin midair on a skateboard.
I got like a 1,200 in his video game. That's nothing.
We did have the Tony Hawk video
those
game.
Those were fun, actually. I really enjoyed those.
One of the last books I read to my kids, because they were getting older, and at bedtime I'd go up there and we'd read, you know, stories. And one of the last books I read to both Grant and Griffin at the same time was the autobiography of Tony Hawk.
Tony Hawk actually has a pretty funny Twitter account because he often gets mistaked for Tony Hawk, but people really just don't believe it's really him.
What do you mean? They come up to him and go, you're not Tony Hawk?
They're like, you look like that skateboarder guy. And they're like, that's so funny because I am. They're like, no, you're not.
Nah, yeah, you're not.
He has all these like accounts of it happening at airports and things like that. It's really entertaining.
Hawk is also an example of, if you want to be that good, have parents that will embrace your vision. His parents were always setting up and allowing him to, like, set up these massive ramps and things. See, it's a nice story. He's been a good guy all these years. All right, it's 2 o'clock, just a few seconds after that now. This is WGN Radio everywhere. White Sox baseball are on the terrestrial side, as we say. You're listening to us at WGNRadio.com, and we appreciate that. Into the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom with the latest and Steve Bertrand.
Thinking big thoughts. So you don't have to.
Hello.
Here's John Williams.
His mic is on, and we're glad you're on WGNRadio.com. I'm not sure how you're listening to us. We are not on the air today. We are on your device or however you're tuning us in, because it's White Sox baseball on the radio, so we do it online still. Remember, you can always tell your smart speaker, play WGN. By the way, with your smart speaker, like you're listening to us maybe now, you can also at any time say, play the Mincing Rascals podcast. Tell your smart speaker to play the Mincing Rascals podcast, and that will work as well. You know, we were just visiting a little while ago with a writer from Slate about Simone Biles' performance, and that led me to a segue to some other great physical feats, the most amazing superhuman sports feats. Stadium Talk had a piece. Roger Bannister, they mentioned his distance running, and then the skydiving effort by Felix Baumgarten and Bob Beamon's long jump. Gertrude Ederle swimming the English Channel. I watched a TED Talk yesterday about this sort of thing, too. And they said that one of the reasons, or one of the interesting things, is that when you compare super athletic performances today to super athletic performances 25, 50, 75, 100 years ago, it's not so much how much better the athletes are as it is the equipment, right? So when Roger Bannister famously breaks the 4-minute barrier in the mile, they say there's no telling how fast he would have run if he'd had lightweight shoes, if he'd had the training and diet regimen that we have today, and if he was running on a spongy track. But he was running on cinders, you know, maybe good cinders. They can get loose, though. And there's just so much you lose with each step. They said that when Jesse Owens ran the 100-meter dash in front of Adolf Hitler in the 36 Olympics in Berlin, the start, he took a gardening trowel and dug out a little hole. This is what you would do. And then you stuck the trowel in the ground behind you. And then you put your foot in that little hole against the trowel. And then you ran on a cinder track. And that's how you ran the 100-meter dash. It's not like that today. The tracks are spongier and faster. The shoes are better, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And in fact, they said that when you actually analyzed how fast his legs were moving mid-race, he was actually going as fast as, say, Usain Bolt was when he set the world record running the 100 meters. And Bolt is famously the fastest person ever, but Bolt has the luxury of being born at a time when the equipment accommodates his skills. Jesse Owens, not so much. I heard one time, so we've been noodling around about this, that Florence Griffith Joyner, who has the women's 100-meter dash record at like 10.6, that she would have beat Jesse Owens in the Olympics in 1936. She would have been the fastest man ever, which says something about her ability, but also just about how the equipment and the field, you know, the tracks sort of accommodate her skills. And who knows how fast Jesse Owens would have run. We looked it up, and actually Owens ran 10.3, she ran 10.6, but she ran 10.6 in the 100 meters, which is farther than Jesse Owens had to run. So she might have been right there with him. Just some fun stuff about physical performances. What do you guys think about them opening up a recreational marijuana shop on the Magnificent Mile? Would that be a great thing, or would that be the same as a low-rent gun store? Or a pawn shop?
It would not be that at all. It would absolutely not be that.
I don't know.
It would be like going into a fine salon.
Would it be? Because
absolutely.
I've only seen a couple of pot shops in my life in Colorado, and they weren't gleaming. They looked kind of low-hung.
Well, this would, I promise you, this would be some sort of...
You see the location they're thinking about putting it?
The old Apple store?
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, a few blocks down from where the Tribune Tower is. I mean, that's, there's the Nike store, and there's the Gap, and there's some, as you get closer to Water Tower Place, some fine end, high end stores. The rent ain't cheap there.
I was going to say, if they can afford to be there, I would guess it's going to be pretty nice.
I guess, right. You wouldn't run
down. You're a little behind on this issue. You're not on board yet.
I am not.
And so I think that's what clouding your... I mean, my son went to one in, I think, Washington State. And, you know, it was like going into a fine wine shop.
Was it really?
Yeah.
And then were people just stumbling around drunk on their, you know, high
no,
out of their...
It's pot. It's not liquor, which you can get anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, you really can get liquor. I mean, think when we were growing up, how hard it was to, not how hard, but how unusual it was to, how it was not typical to have a restaurant serve beer, right?
A restaurant?
I mean, you know, most restaurants. I mean, now you go into the Knopf Knopf Grill or you go into Rhodey. You know, there's you go into Chipotle, right? I think they sell beer there, too.
I don't remember. Until recently, Minnesota did not sell alcohol at grocery stores. You couldn't get, you'd have to go to a different store to get your alcohol. I'm talking 2 years ago.
Oregon still does that. They don't have hard alcohol at
really?
Their grocery store.
So if you want to get whiskey, you got to go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
I think in Wisconsin, Indiana, you can't sell cold beer at a gas station. No, it's true. But you can sell cold bottles of wine or cold bottles of any other sort of hard cider.
And explain the logic of that to me, Steve.
I don't.
Oh, you try.
Well, when I went to Purdue, they didn't sell anything at all on Sundays.
Yeah. I mean, they're eliminating the convenience. It's cold, you'll drink it now in your car.
Right.
It's, although Sundays is the day?
No, yeah. any day in the cold beers, any day.
No, but I'm talking to Lauren
about... You know,
about
when I went to school there, they didn't
Purdue.
Sell anything on Sunday. So if
that's
you,
a blue law,
yeah,
then.
If you wanted to have a drink, you know, watching football or something, you would have to buy everything ahead of time.
The point, my point, though, is you can now sit on Lake Michigan in Chicago and Park District land and drink a beer. You know, and that would have been unheard of 10 or 20 years ago. The idea that there'd be taverns, public park district taverns on the beach, you know, they just didn't allow that stuff. And I don't think it was out of prudishness. I don't know exactly what it was about, but, you know, now it seems like you can buy beer, you can go shopping to the grocery store and drink a beer.
I think you can get it at a drive-through at some gas stations in Texas, which, again, I get it. You know, what's the difference between a drive-through and going in? Either way, you're going in to buy alcohol, and then you're going to put it in your car, and you're going to drive away.
In Ohio, the liquor stores are drive-through. They're like garages.
That's crazy.
And you literally drive in, and the guy comes up to your car and says, what do you want?
I understand the fallacy with my logic here, the problem with my logic here, but you could not make it any easier to drink and drive.
Now, that's a convenience store.
Than if you...
Anyway, so we've changed so much, my point. And so this idea that you're afraid of a marijuana store, a marijuana where I'm sure will be finely curated product.
Yeah, you watch. Well, you're right that if my trepidation about marijuana stores were consistent, then I would think at liquor stores you'd have just a bunch of drunks stumbling around everywhere. That every Benny's would just be this haven of, you know, bad behavior. And it's not. So I guess
there's that one is, but
but I don't know. Times are changing, Johnny boy. You gotta get on board.
You are gonna be a frequent flyer once this starts.
And I've never took, so I don't know.
Oh, see, well, there you go.
I'm not. If I ever consume it, it'll be a
gummy.
Yeah, something like that.
Or an edible.
I'm not smoking. Because I'm worried about my lungs.
I think it'd be a good show.
Do you watch Jimmy Kimmel, Jimmy Fallon, where he does day drinking? Have you watched that yet? We talked about this one time. He literally gets drunk with celebrities. So they tape it, and they'll spend several hours at a place, and they'll just drink themselves silly. I mean, copious amounts of liquor. And then they get silly, and then they videotape it, you know, tape the whole thing. And then they edit it, and they play it back, and it's pretty funny. But talk about mixed messages. All right, so nobody has any problem with a pot shop on Michigan Avenue right there as your kids are walking by, your tourists, they see it in Chicago. Let's just pop in.
Hey, I would be more worried about it getting robbed.
Oh, that's right, because it's all cash.
I don't know if it will be all cash. I mean,
well, they don't.
Are we still not past that?
No. Well, it's still a federal crime. No bank. It's hard for those people to put the cash anywhere. Well, that's what it is. It's hard for them to find a bank to take their money
because the banks don't want to play.
But I don't know if they. I don't know how you pay for it. Can you use a credit card at a marijuana store in Oregon or Washington or
I'm
wherever?
Not entirely sure, but from most people that I've heard, no.
Yeah, I don't think so. I think it's a cash only business, and the banks don't want it, so they have to find a place to put it.
Well, I think the banks take it, but they just say you'd have to make your deposits in cash. You know what I mean? So that's the problem, is you're bringing bags full of money. That used to be the problem in Denver. I don't know if they've gotten around that or not yet.
Somebody call me, 312-981-7200. What do you know and what do you think about this? 312-981-7200.
I bet Michigan Avenue, the stores, are dying for it. Because retail needs a reason for people to hang around and walk around again.
Rents are down in Chicago on Michigan Avenue, where you were getting $500 a square foot. Now they're getting $450.
They're going to do a strip joint next.
Well, that's it. Let's get we okay, can get
then,
us.
Then I'm on board with you.
A strip joint, marijuana store. We'll get a gun store, and then we'll get a place, a pawn shop, and I don't know what else. Some go-go dancers. Anything else that would kind of just...
No, I don't think that's going to be the case.
That's your big four.
I mean, who wouldn't want to have a retail store next to a place where people are getting high and sort of losing a little control?
See, there you go. You're not helping your cause.
Jack the prices up a little bit.
It's exactly.
If you come from the east.
You know, my biggest problem with all of this is that the state, to get more money, is actually pushing a drug on the people. At the end of the day, that's it. You can do the law, you can do whatever you want about people shouldn't be going to jail and it's no worse than alcohol. I get that. I've been singing that song. But it's not been legal, and now it is. And the reason it is because the state wants you to get high so that they can take some money from you. That's it. That's the equation.
Do you feel that way about sports gambling?
Stand by while I think about that. Maybe. Maybe, although sports gambling doesn't bother me as much as marijuana does.
See, that's funny. We're completely opposite then, because I feel that way about sports gambling. Now, every sports cast, sports show is all going to be about betting. And that doesn't interest me. And so I don't like that they're making that legal just for cash.
If you had to pick your vice, you'd put marijuana shops on Michigan Avenue before you allowed people to bet from home on the Illini game. That's not an extraordinary statement.
No, it is in a way, but not because I care about those people betting from home. I couldn't care less. It's just that I don't want sports now to become only about betting.
And the line and stuff like that.
Exactly.
312-981-7200. Thanks for tuning in. Text or call now. This is WG. By the way, a couple of you said that Seth Meyers does the day drinking. I think I gave it to Jimmy Fallon. Seth Meyers does that. So Google that and enjoy. The space, by the way, for that Apple store that might be the next retail point for recreational marijuana in Chicago. It's halfway between, say, the Tribune Tower and Water Tower Place on the east side of Michigan Avenue. Stone's throw from where we used to broadcast. Still pretty close to where we are right now. And the article in the Tribune that was talking a little bit about this said that the price per square foot, the rent that they were able to get was, let's see here. Well, now it's just, I thought I'd have it in the time it took me to say all of that. There it is. In Chicago, leases for top MagMile spaces averaged $450 per square foot in 2018, down from $550 the previous 2 years. So off 100 from 550 to 450. And some of the big chains, or, you know, these real estate holding companies that own a lot of that land, they don't, or a lot of that retail space, they don't want to get in the marijuana business. They don't want to deal with that. They don't want to lease the space to people that are doing something that is still against the law. It's a federal crime. Illinois can legalize it. Other states can legalize it, but it's still a federal crime. And they don't want their tenants engaged in that kind of business. John Rose said the ones in California look like Apple stores. They're very nice. John 773 has texted in and said about a marijuana shop on Michigan Avenue, I'm okay with it as long as there's a Taco Bell next door. 630, hey, John, check out this tweet from 2012 from Donald Trump. If the Dow ever dropped 1,000 points in 2 days, the president should be impeached immediately. The Dow's off 780. 773, the honeypot in Toronto is completely high-end in an expensive area, and you get a very polite associate that walks you around and then places your order, and then you pick it up at the checkout. It's beautiful decor, the pot store in Toronto. 219 said, Indiana used to have a law that you couldn't buy more than 4 cases of beer a day. It may still be the law. Since it relies on the honor system, it's pretty much unenforceable. That's right, because you could go to the one liquor store and then go to the next one, and I don't know if they'd say, hey, have you already bought 4 cases, Clem? And then you have to answer honestly, otherwise the law has no teeth. 630 says Western Michigan has drive-through liquor stores. The lane was open at night to prevent holdups. This was 35 years ago. I get that. Not a bad idea. Not a bad idea.
No, in Ohio, though, there's no barrier. You just drive through on the track like you're going to get your oil changed. And there's just cases of beer piled up on either side.
Oh, really?
All kinds of liquor bottles.
Yeah, yeah.
Just point out, I'll take that Modelo, and I'll take that Sam Adams.
815 says, John, have you never seen Drunk History? I have. I don't think it's that funny. 269, I was just at a shop in Colorado last week. They took my debit card. 815 said, King John, most communities in southern Illinois and the Bible Belt region are still dry on Sunday. Are you kidding me? Really? Where was it? Was it Western Springs was dry until recently? Yeah, I guess there are still some suburbs maybe that just don't want that business.
Well, look, you can't buy a car on a Sunday.
Yeah, when I get to be king, that's going to change. Never understood that. Water Tower Realty has not responded to requests from the Tribune for comment about...
Yeah, they own or they run the that site, the Apple site.
Yeah. And we should reach out to them, see what they think. 55 medical dispensaries. I didn't know the state of Illinois had that many. We have 55 medical dispensaries in Illinois. And they can sell recreational marijuana at their stores, or they can apply to sell it there. And they can also open a second dispensary. So there's at least 55 people that are already going to be eligible to sell it, as long as they can pay the rent and the landlord will let them.
Well, I think those companies get those, the existing dispensaries sort of have a leg up. I don't know that they're guaranteed, but in Naperville, there I think are one or two medical marijuana dispensaries, and Naperville has voted to not allow recreational marijuana. So those dispensaries are sort of, you know, left holding the bag.
Yeah, well, I guess they still get to sell it.
I'm sorry.
I guess they still get to sell their medicinal marijuana.
Right.
But didn't you always think that a lot of people that were getting in that game, because it wasn't inexpensive to get in, were doing so that they'd be in once they could sell recreational? I would imagine that's where the real money's to be made.
What's the point of selling medical once it is recreational? Wouldn't it all just be the same?
Well,
no, it won't.
I don't know if it's covered or not covered by insurance.
Oh, insurance. Well, also probably a limit of what you can get.
Well, and I don't think that you necessarily get high on the medical marijuana. I mean, I think some of them have reduced or they find a way to eliminate the whatever the thing is that makes you...
THC.
Yeah. 912 says has to be a bank that is only in that state. If it goes into more than one, the bank, then it's federal and it becomes illegal. Yeah. So Citibank, Wells Fargo, Chase Manhattan, they cannot take the deposits for the marijuana. Yeah, my understanding was that a lot of banks won't take the money from these stores. And if they're in more than one state, then they're in a state, then they're federal, and then it's illegal. How about that? 706 said John Roe Khan just talked about his experience buying pot at a store in California the other day. I figured that's what he was alluding to. I missed that. Did he go into great length about that, Lauren Lapka?
He did. He said that it's similar to kind of what someone else had said. There's like associates that walk around with an iPad, like an Apple store, to help individuals. And everything's like behind a glass case, and like all the actual marijuana is behind a shelf, like in a refrigerator or something like that, like some closed off shelf.
Buddy of mine, his son is a pot docent or whatever they call it. They have a funny name for him, not barista. Anyway, and he said that people will come up to him and say, you know, I want to get some of this recreational marijuana. And they'll say, what do you want to use it for? Well, I just want to take the edge off, or I want to relax, or I want to concentrate, or I want to sleep, or I want to get high, or I want it to go good with this or with that. And then they'll kind of say, well, we recommend this or we recommend that. And you don't have to go to school for that, I don't think.
No, it's all based on the balance of, like, the THC and whatever else is in it. Because the THC, I guess, is more of the kind of winds you up and...
Go to school for it. You used to drop out of school to do it.
But don't you think you should have a degree in whatever the equivalent of pharmacology is for marijuana if you're going to be selling something that has a quasi-medicinal use?
It's not medicinal if it's recreational, and you don't for wine.
That's
what,
true.
Do you want something to go with your fish or your steak?
224 said, King John, I don't believe possession charges should be expunged. It's like getting a speeding ticket, doing 60 and a 55. Then they raise the limit to 70. Should our speeding tickets be expunged?
No, but your speeding tickets leave your record after a few years.
Yeah, yeah. It's 230. All right, I still have a couple things we need to get to, but we'll continue to follow stories like these, I guess, in the coming months. You ready to roll in there, Mr. Bertrand?
Sure.
It's time for WGN Radio News. This is Steve Bertrand. On WGN. Thank you, Steve Bertrand, for the news. I'm John Williams. Ashley Byhun is producing our show today. Elif Garris is away for a couple days. This time we like to feature a little bit of music for reasons that the producer decides while you're playing John Mayer.
We're playing John Mayer today because he is going to be at the United Center today and tomorrow, the 14th and the 15th, at 7:30. Tickets are still available, and they range anywhere between $70 and $430. So depending on where you want to sit and how big your bank account is, you have options.
Bank account is lower today, probably. Just looking at the Dow closing in on, what's the number now? Let's see, Steve just walked away. And CNN I just switched away from, but it was off about 800. Yeah, John Mayer's nice to listen to. Thanks for that. Take our mind off of the markets. I actually sent a text message to a friend of ours here at Private Vista. Bob Westrick is one of the principals over there. Remember myprivatevista.com? We talk about them on the radio sometimes. Bob's a financial guru, so I just sent him a note and said, hey, what's going on? Should we talk to you on the radio? He says, I'm at the lake. I don't have my phone. He wasn't following the markets just then, which I felt bad because I just ruined his vacation day. He's probably enjoying some sunshine. He might be having a lemonade. And then somebody says, hey, what about the markets? And he says, texted me back and said, oh, crap, this doesn't look good. But I wouldn't read anything into that except he just found out. So the market's off about 800. And it's not just because of the usual. Lately, we've seen these sorts of swings because China does something and then the president says something and then we make a concession. We'll wait until Christmas and then everybody can go shopping. So hold your jets and then the market bounces back. But then, well, here, I'll just pull it up here, give you just a little further analysis of what's going on. It's CNBC's reporting on it today. They say that the Dow plunges 750. After bond market flashes a recession warning, Citigroup tanks 5%. It's actually more than 750. I'll get you a number here in a second, but stocks have plunged today, giving back Tuesday's solid gains after the bond market flashed troubling signals about the U.S. economy. The Dow Jones Industrial Average dropped 758 points, or 2.8%, while the S&P fell 2.7%, NASDAQ off 2.9%. The Dow fell to a new low for August, giving up the entire rebound from a sell-off earlier in the month. The yield on benchmark 10-year Treasury notes on Wednesday broke below the 2-year rate. It's an odd, and you and I don't know what all of that means, it's an odd bond market phenomenon that has been a reliable indicator of economic recessions. Investors worried about the state of the economy rushed to long-term safe haven assets, pushing the yield on the benchmark 30-year Treasury bond to a new record low on Wednesday. Bank stocks led the declines as it gets tougher for the group to make a profit lending money in such an environment. The U.S. equity market is on borrowed time after the yield curve inverts, wrote Bank of America technical strategist Stephen Suttmeyer. So we'll see what your 401ks and stuff like that are going to be like here in the near future. I'll wait for the market to just flash up the latest, but we've been trading at around off 800, and as we get closer to the finish line this afternoon, it seems to be getting worse rather than better. You know, the other thing, Ashley, that I needed you to find for me was I don't see the copy. Here it is. So we'll get started on this. 75-year-old license. This is from the Chicago Tribune. Jason Meisner, Annie Sweeney, and Dan Moran's story. A 75-year-old licensed concealed carry gun owner shot and killed a 14-year-old Chicago boy when a group of teens appeared at his Lake County home Tuesday morning, with the group then taking off in a high-speed chase that ended in Chicago when the stolen car they were driving ran out of gas. Tuesday night, the group of Chicago teens has been charged with first-degree murder. Think about that. The teenagers have been charged with first-degree murder. What happened was they came out to rob, it looks like, some old guy's car. There's a 70-plus-year-old, a 75-year-old homeowner went outside to see why there were people near his parked 2011 Audi. The 75-year-old yells at this group of five kids to get away from his car. At least one male moved toward him with an unknown object in his hand. That man then shoots the young man, who's 14 years old. Turns out that he had a Bowie knife with him. So he shoots these kids that are trying to steal his car. He's standing out there. One of them comes at him, and I believe that young man, the 14-year-old that was killed, had a big knife at him, and he's coming at him. So this guy shoots and kills the kid. They all then jump in the car with that kid and take off. Speeds reach 120 miles an hour. Eventually, the vehicle runs out of gas. The young man was pronounced dead at the hospital that he was taken to. The other four, then, are charged with first-degree murder. They are charged with that young man's murder. That law is kind of new, and you don't hear about that often. I think that makes perfect sense. I think that makes perfect sense, because I'm thinking a 14-year-old. Now, it's been explained to me that some 14-year-olds and 15-year-olds and 16-year-olds are involved in these kinds of crimes in Chicago because they won't face the same sort of charges that their adult buddies will, so they sometimes will bring those kids along to do some of the heavy lifting. I mean, the 14-year-old's much more easily manipulated. So let's go after the manipulators, then. And so while this guy shoots and kills that kid in his own defense, those other older young men actually get charged with pulling the trigger. Will the man himself be charged? They said we're waiting to do more investigating. But I don't think a 75-year-old going out to see what's going on and sees a kid coming at him with a knife has to do too much explaining. I have a lot of sympathy for these kids on the streets. I think there, but for the grace of God, go a lot of our kids. But in the man's case, if you've got a group of five stealing your car, one of them coming at you with a knife, and you have a gun, yeah, I think you get to discharge your weapon. Deadly force may only be used if he or she reasonably, this is the law, reasonably believes that such force is necessary to prevent imminent death or great bodily harm. What that means is that a great deal depends on the circumstances of the case, most of which are not yet publicly known, University of Illinois criminal law professor Andrew Leopold said. Fair enough. But based on what we understand so far, I'm feeling for that kid, or for that man, and for that kid, too. I'm angriest at the accomplices. Someone having something in their hand is not enough to justify force, but if a stranger is approaching threateningly in the dark in the desired area, it may be. More to come on that. Pete McMurray is a regular voice here at WGN Radio. Fills in on this show a lot. So well, I get nervous when I'm away. Pete's on line 7. Hi, Pete. How are you this afternoon?
Don't worry. Your job is absolutely safe. You are good.
And that's the last thing they say before your butt hits the door.
By the way, can I say something about that last story? I have a 14-year-old son, and I'm watching that on the news last night, and I'm thinking, what is going on with our society? You're absolutely right that they grab these small kids, they talk them into doing these things, and next thing you know, someone dies. It's terrible.
Yeah, and so, hey, 14-year-old, don't do that. But 14-year-old is really wet clay to me. But the 18-year-old that's pushing him in that direction, now that's the one that needs to go to jail.
120-mile-an-hour chase.
No.
Where was it? Gurnee to downtown.
Yeah. Imagine that. It's amazing more people weren't killed.
Man.
You're going to talk to the mayor tonight, aren't you?
I'm going to talk to Lori Lightfoot. When you attend enough events in the city, you run into her all the time, and we found out we have mutual friends, and I could just say, hey, do you want to come on and talk about this? And she's been kind enough to do that with me, which has been great.
You probably are about as connected to the city as anybody I know, right? Like, when you are at events, you are always bumping into people, and they all know you. A lot of us fake that. You actually are that.
Well, I am a guy that I don't have any reservations about approaching someone, especially someone that's running for mayor when we originally met. I'm like, you need to come on my show. I mean, I don't have a problem with that, with people. I mean, what's the most they can say? No, I'm not going to do it.
Yeah, no, fair enough. No, but it sounds like you and her go back even farther. But you didn't know her? You didn't meet her until she started running?
I met her. She was on the board with one of my friends, and I met her at a fundraiser a few years ago, and we've connected through other people. And when she was running for mayor, I kept running into her. And when she became mayor, it's like, okay, I got to call in that favor with our mutual friend, and she came on the show.
Wow, nice, nice.
Yeah.
What are y'all going to talk about tonight?
Well, I mean, you know, people getting shot in the city. What, we have like 100 people in the last 2 weeks?
Yeah.
Double digits are dead. I mean, what's the next step? We talk about tougher gun laws. Is that actually going to happen in the state of Illinois?
I don't know. You know, we did the Mincing Rascals podcast last week, and one of them said that one of the candidates on the campaign trail said, we can't arrest this problem. So cracking down on juvenile delinquents or criminals is not the solution. There'll be more juvenile delinquents. There'll be more criminals. You can't arrest the problem. I'm not even sure, Pete, if the ultimate solution or something to just make it better, I'm not even sure it's gun laws. I'm all for them, but I think it's broader than that, right? We need more jobs and more pay equity and stuff like that, you know.
You need to develop those neighborhoods. How many zip codes are in Chicago? Like 60 plus? Is that about right?
Maybe.
60 zip codes,
yeah.
And this violence happens in 5 or 6 of those zip codes. And that's one of the things that she's trying to do. She goes to these neighborhoods every single weekend. She's been doing this since Memorial Day. And she's on the ground. I want to find out what people are saying to her and what she's saying to them.
Don't you love her attitude, though? Don't you love that's her demeanor and her words are literally, I don't have time for your nonsense, you know? What is it, aldermanic privilege? let's not do that anymore. I don't want to do that. I just love her no-nonsense attitude.
You're right. I love it, too. And I love that she wants to find, she continues to solve a problem. I mean, by going in the neighborhoods, one thing you could say, okay, we're going to send more police officers there, but she's going every single weekend. You got to give her props for that.
I would not want to be mayor of Chicago.
Oh, God, no. I tell that to her all the time. I mean, all people want to do is come to you with their problems.
Yeah.
I need to be a manager of anything.
Yeah, no kidding.
Right. In the casino, are you a gambler?
No, I'm not. And I'm very interested, though, in the five, you know, areas that they're considering. Do you have an opinion about that? Do you know she has an opinion about that?
I have always read that she liked the Michael Reese Hospital location, but who knows? I'll ask her about that tonight. But I mean, selfishly, I live downtown, so I'd like to see a casino. Why not McCormick Place, that big black building that sits empty? Why wouldn't they put a casino in there? Of course, she wants to develop these underprivileged neighborhoods, so I can understand that. But
wait, McCormick Place is empty?
That black building, you know, they have two different buildings.
Oh, the one on the east side of Lakeshore.
The one on the east side, yes.
That's empty?
Nothing happens in that building.
Really? That doesn't go used?
They never use it. They put the car show in the building that's west of Lakeshore Drive. Yeah. I think the Aragon Ballroom they use once in a while.
Wow.
That's about it.
Somebody smart said to me that the casinos should go where the money is. So if you say west side or south side, don't put it there because casinos are money drains. The casinos take money from people. You don't get rich. It doesn't develop communities. It sucks money out of communities. So put it on Navy Pier where tourists can, or put it on the north side where people have money to lose. Don't put it at Michael Reese. Don't put it on the south side because those people can't afford to lose the money.
But if you put it at Michael Reese Hospital, don't you think there's going to be restaurants that are opening up nearby or hotels that are going to be opening up nearby? Of course they're going to develop that area. I mean, I grew up in Peoria. That's what happened in Peoria when they brought in the riverboats. And how about Elgin? The Grand Victoria. I mean, they developed that like crazy. They have outdoor concerts now. So, you know, you can't tell people what to do, but if you bring a business, how much is a casino going to bring? You know, $300 million every single year? That's going to bring development to that neighborhood.
You are on board, aren't you?
I am. I really am. I want to see a casino. I'm tired of driving to Indiana to gamble.
Do you do that?
Sure. Yes.
I'm not judging. Wait, I want to say that again in a non-judgmental way. Oh, really? Do you do that?
I've been to Horseshoe twice this summer, once on a boat and once we drove there.
Does your wife game with you too then?
Oh, God, no. No. I mean, I'll go with buddies and we'll hang out.
What are the rules for Pete McMurray as he says goodbye to his wife off to the casino?
Don't spend your entire paycheck.
Well, like, literally, do you guys set a limit amount?
No, but I mean, I love the fun of playing blackjack and craps because everybody's screaming and having a good time and you're having drinks, but I'm not going to spend that much money. I know there's a voice in my head that says, okay, you've lost enough, time to walk away.
So you don't worry about that? Your wife doesn't worry about that?
No, not at all.
I played blackjack once, on a boat, on a cruise ship. And I thought, this is fun. So I took $100 down there and I lost it faster than if I had just given him a $100 bill and ran out. I mean, literally, like I said, red and black, I got a 50-50 shot. Everything, and then I'll cover it. And I was just playing to have fun. I could not have liquidated that money faster.
That does happen a lot. It really does.
So what's the trick? Give me some tips here, Pete McMurray, in case I go there again.
Go to a table, if you're not experienced, go to a table where it's probably, you can find a $10 table. You don't want to start at 25 because you're going to lose the 100 right away.
And people are going to be angry because you're going to be playing wrong, right?
Well, you need to play by the book. You can look it up, you can have it on your phone, or you can ask people around you and make sure the people at your table, at your blackjack table, are playing by the book because the book always wins.
I don't even know what
odds.
Well, I don't even know what you just said, play by the book.
Well, if you have, you're looking at a 10 underneath and you have a 10 on top, you're at 20, you know, you don't want to hit, right?
Right.
Or if anything over 17, you do not hit. Even if you have a feeling, you do not hit. You let it ride. You let it go.
And should the other people's cards that are displayed tell me much? Like, are you looking at that going, well, there's 2 8s out already or some blah, 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 blah?
If you can pay attention, sure. Yeah. But just keep telling the people. You got to play by the book.
Are you into the sports gambling then that we're going to get in Illinois?
Not as much as my friends. I mean, they're very excited about it. They're very excited.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, any type of anything that we can do in the state to bring in revenue, I'm all for. Because we need help.
I know. That's okay. So I'll just finish with this. Pete McMurray's got Mayor Lori Lightfoot on WGN Radio and WGNRadio.com tonight. 10:15, is that the tip-off for you two?
10:15, and one more thing. The mayor and I have something in common. We're both season ticket holders for the Chicago Bears. So we're going to be talking Bears tonight, too.
See, I haven't heard her talk sports. Is she can she chat around that topic pretty well?
I think so. We'll find out. She's been a season ticket holder for 20 years, so she's going to the games.
Very interesting. Very interesting. All right, Mr. Pete McMurray. Always, thanks for filling in for me when I go away sometimes. And we'll listen for you on the radio at 10 o'clock. Is that when you start tonight?
10 o'clock, 10 to 1. And thank you for having me on.
Okay, we'll see you, Pete.
All right, see you, buddy. Bye.
Pete McMurray. Anna DeVlantis is in the studio getting ready for the show with Ro.
Hi, John.
Just found out some things about Pete I didn't know.
His gambling proclivities?
That's the word, proclivities. Do you have gambling proclivities?
You know, I was just at Four Winds Casino this past weekend, but it's my husband and mom who like to gamble. So they sort of drag me in there, and I just sit and go online on my iPad, and they have fun. I just don't find any, it's not a thrill for me.
Do you play the slots?
No. I just don't.
You don't do anything?
On occasion I do, but that particular day I didn't because they were just sort of, they wanted to go in and play blackjack. My mom likes to do the slots, and they love it. And I'm like, all right, let's spend an hour and a half, and then we're going to go get dinner together. So it was that kind of thing. But they love it. And there's another, situation where people leave the city to go out to.
Oh, yeah, taking their dollars elsewhere. Yeah. Yeah. So you're maybe like Pete. If it's going to happen, let's do it here.
Yeah, I mean, I was a little disturbed if you are okay with the idea of having a casino here, and I think many people are in terms of the tax dollars, and why not keep them here? I was a little disturbed by that feasibility study saying that all five of the suggested locations would not work, would not be profitable, and that people don't want to basically leave the downtown district. You're not going to get tourists if you try to go anywhere kind of in a certain radius from the city.
I was also, was it the sports betting or was it the casinos that they said the city just wants too much of a take from the revenues from the casinos as it is?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the numbers, they're just saying that it's financially a mess for anybody who would want to ever bid on it. I mean, it sounds great for the state to say, hey, we're going to charge you $15 million up front just for the license. We're going to charge you $30,000 per seat. Meaning every slot machine,
really?
Every spot at a gambling table, every blackjack seat. And it sounds great. But then when the guys looking at the bids started saying, hey, when you do the math on this,
we can't make any money.
You're looking single digits. And that might not be enough room for you to jump in.
Well, I think it was 75% was the percent that the city wanted on sports gambling revenues. So whoever's operating that has to kick 75% of it. That sounds impossible, but so help me, that was the number I saw, would have to go to the city or state. And that's just not a, I think, reasonable business model for you to expect somebody to take, like, well, then skip it. I'll open a grocery store or something.
Yeah, or I'll open up a casino somewhere else.
Yeah, or that. Yeah. What are you guys doing this afternoon?
Well, we do not have Mayor Lightfoot on, although I'm interested in hearing what she has to say. There's a lot going on her way. But we've got, let me ask my producer.
I know, I was just going to say.
Sometimes I don't always know everything.
Well, I'm looking at Ashley. Do I need to take a break first, Ash, before we do this?
And okay. I'll figure out what we've got coming up.
This will be just like a radio.